Welcome to One Inch Part Scary Podcast. I'm Kirsty Sayer, and I am super excited today to have one of my most favorite, most beloved people on the planet joining me, my little brother Seth, who may be younger than me, but is a big brother to me in every sense, has been an incredible support and wise counselor and comforter and guide and unconditionally loving family member for as long as I have alive, practically, bar 3 years. Yeah. Those 3 years were hell.
I was going to say with a few little interruptions. Yes.
Took some space from time to time while we were working things out, but not for very long. We've been through some tumultuous times, each of us. In recent years, or basically lifelong, really. Once we've come to unpack things, we've realized that we've been through some stuff, and we are both inclined. We both sort of feel a similar pull towards the work of sharing what we have learned in sort of a clinical or therapeutic manner, and presenting it to other people in, I think, a way that's packaged so that, I suppose, our particular group of people who's supposed to understand it from us can. And I know that your way of presenting...
accessible. I think accessible to people who have had similar experiences.
Right, and I think that your way of presenting knowledge and helping me through, certainly, PTSD, even before I understood what it was... always really reached me in a way that few other things ever have been able to. And I've repeated some of the really great nuggets that I've sort of clung to in moments of dire crisis to people who were experts and who knew much more in terms of, you know, counseling people. And they were always blown away and stunned by how insightful you were and how helpful you were and, you know, how beautifully you put things. And so I know that you're really modest about this and you tend to downplay it, but I am constantly amazed by Seth's ability to articulate difficult concepts and also to see through the gross sludge and find the beauty and, you know, and how we can learn and grow and get closer to the source, whoever that may be. We both started out, we started out our lives in similar places. We were raised more or less the same, in the same religion and everything. Yeah. And we're both extremely spiritually inclined people. Seth is religious. I am not anymore.
And I think for a while it felt like we were diverging spiritually, but I think spiritually we're
closer together than we ever have been, really.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think we have
sort of doctrinal differences or dogmatic differences, but spiritually I think we're very much in a similar place.
And I think what's been fascinating to me is that at a point where I was exceptionally triggered regarding my religious background, we sort of almost despaired for our relationship because the religion and the spirituality connected to the dogma is super important to you. And I was in a place where I just was very closed off to anything. And it was almost impossible to communicate on those grounds.
Yeah. And I think it kind of highlights complex PTSD where everything... You know, my therapist speaks about it like a Christmas tree with multiple strands of lights and how one light is interconnected to all the others. And so if I come with a religious point of view or a religious framework, that just lights up everything in the past, all of the abuse, all of the trauma. And we were scared that it was always going to be like that. But the beauty of healing is that those interconnected, you know, things that don't need to be connected that were through the trauma start to kind
stand
of be,
alone, yeah.
Yes, exactly. They start getting detangled, and you can see things in, in their own context.
That's so true. And
And yeah.
a thought occurred to me right now as we were talking about this, and just it was so painful. It was brutal because we didn't have very many people in the world, each other, beyond each other, who understood exactly what we'd been through. And you'd been a fierce, once you discovered what
And
had
took it
happened to me,
seriously.
you were a fierce, fierce protector of me, and so integral to my healing. But then, the religious stuff sort of got in the way for a while, and it was so heartbreaking. And I really feel like people should take a lot of hope, in knowing that that can really change and that can evolve. And don't give up on people if they've left, and there will probably be people from, the Mormon faith listening to this just through our mutual connections, and who will know people who have left their faith. Don't give up on people because of that, because I really feel like we've been able to have such a spiritual connection in terms of our shared spirituality now
Absolutely.
that we are so on the same page. You're not triggered by the language that I use regarding my spirituality, and I'm not triggered by the language you use anymore. I think you were always open. It was me who just couldn't cope.
No, but I think, the thing is, in relationships, be it, a spousal relationship, a, brother, sister, whatever, father, son, whatever, there is so much interconnectedness that you can sometimes despair that a relationship has been so tainted by trauma that it can never recover. And there are certain fundamentals that I think we can get into later. If certain fundamentals haven't been violated, that relationship can bounce back with enough time and healing. There's certain inviolate things that, make certain relationships irreparable, to a certain extent. But, I've had times where my wife and I are triggering each other because we're each innocently poking at the other person's trauma, and you despair because you think, how will this ever resolve itself? And yet with healing and therapy, it does, and you reclaim the innocence of those relationships with time. And it's so important to remember that, because in the moment it feels like all is
It
lost.
does, and it was actually, oh gosh, as if things weren't hard enough on us as we were, unraveling everything and re-experiencing things and working through them and just all that. You had also just moved to the US with, left a job, left your family, your social life. Everything you'd known, you had two young kids, and you were in a completely different culture. And I was your only sibling, your only, connection to,
Family on the
yes,
continent.
and you were mine. And there was something that I'd always dreamed of. I was, and then it was just tragic because, and we aren't even very plain, we had opportunities to be with each other, and there were, it was just tragic, and it felt like the ultimate, one more thing that had been stolen from us. And so that was so hard. And I think it dovetails really well into the theme for today. Because I think both of us experienced a need to create boundaries, which was we had not had experience with in our whole lives. We were trained,
And even between, boundaries between you, well, I mean, maybe it's
between
obvious, but
ourselves.
boundaries
Yeah,
between
that's
you and
what I
I,
mean.
yeah, you and
We
I,
had to create boundaries in our
exactly.
relationship, so as to protect ourselves while we were both so incredibly raw. All right, I'll be back.
Technical hits.
Okay, we're back after some technical difficulties. Hopefully, I'll be able to splice the first 10 minutes of our conversation into this. But anyway, Seth, go for it. Take it away, what you were talking about with boundaries and people with PTSD and boundaries.
So I think, what I realized as I started to understand PTSD is that, and I think I'd come to realize this beforehand, but it really became really, very clear that, I had been raised in an environment where boundaries, didn't exist, and where they weren't tolerated, they weren't permitted. And so, same. And so, no way. What a coincidence.
Amazing.
So I think for anyone who's been raised in a boundaryless environment or where boundaries were kind of criminalized, a boundary, establishing a boundary feels like death.
It feels
terminal, and it feels it feels like you're committing a crime. And so
against humanity, if you're the one,
exactly.
Yeah, if you're the one doing it, it's so cruel, and it's so counterintuitive to what we have been taught is good and kind and right and just.
And so unforgivable, just so unforgivable, especially when you felt the pain, because you will experience people establishing boundaries as pure rejection and betrayal.
Abandonment.
And so if you establish a boundary, you've gone and turned on whoever you've done that to and abandoned them in the way that is so painful to yourself. So it feels like, it feels like a crime against humanity.
And people who have been raised, I must always interject that people have been raised with abuse as children. We're often groomed for that kind of abuse, or sort of like wired, either wired or groomed for it, because they're empathic kind of people.
Mm.
And so they are very, you know, they're careful not to hurt. And so they've been told both implicitly and explicitly that if they try to, you know, enforce a boundary to protect themselves, well, that's very hurtful, or that's not okay, or that's punishable by all these things. All of the above messages were drilled into me.
Exactly.
So when a healthy boundary comes about, you can't differentiate.
No,
and you
absolutely.
You also don't want to do it to somebody because you're a nice person.
Mm.
Yeah.
I just remember watching TV where kids would close their doors and parents would knock on the door and ask to come in. And just laughing hysterically, you know, it seemed
like in wonder.
Yeah, just like whatever, you know, as if.
Like as if.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like akin to showing a 3-year-old, you know, lighting up a cigarette and smoking at the dinner table with their parents.
Right. Come on, now. As if you're seeing somebody give a 4-year-old the keys to a car and
exactly.
Say,
it's,
yeah,
I'm just like, that's
so unfathomable.
That's just a TV program. That's not real life.
That's actually, we laugh, but that's gross. It's sad.
And I think it's so important to create an environment deliberately with your children where they are allowed to express their own innate sense of boundaries, because those boundaries get taken down when children are young, and most of it is completely unintentional. So, you know, it sounds as if, you know, people maliciously go out trying to defy the boundaries, and some people do. But a lot of the time it's just innocently transferring learned behaviors onto the next generation.
Right.
And maybe we can unpack that later on in terms of, you know, how do you respect your children's boundaries?
And teach them to celebrate them, help them to understand when a boundary is healthy or, you know, when they might be being manipulated or.
Exactly.
All that kind of thing is so important. Yeah. So today I asked you what you wanted to talk about, because I'm fully up for whatever you have in mind. You know, it's always good.
Cool.
And the theme that was kind of pressing on you was the importance of, you can say it because I don't want to mess it up.
No. Yeah. I'm not precious about it. It's basically the interplay between boundaries and forgiveness. And I sort of come at it from a Christian viewpoint, where forgiveness is, a lauded virtue and something that we aspire to. And I think as human beings, it's a pretty universally
I think it's on a higher
recognized
plane,
virtue.
A spiritual way to live, to forgive, to transcend anger and grudges and all of that, is to, you know, to understand. I think anybody who's transcended or is trying to transcend a very base level of living can tell that one is hurt by a lack of forgiveness.
Absolutely.
Or a lack of at least moving on, if you don't want to use that vocabulary.
Yeah.
A lack of letting go of past hurts.
Exactly. And I think for me, I had a sort of gradual but very profound awakening to the fact that I had misunderstood forgiveness my whole life.
Yes,
indeed. And that I had kind of mistook boundarylessness for forgiveness. And so for me, embracing boundaries and embracing forgiveness simultaneously has been, you know, very life affirming and very healing. And I think what I want to try and pair out is for someone who does identify as, you know, either Christian or Judeo-Christian or any religious, I mean, it's not a Christian phenomenon, but any or religious or spiritual tradition where you're
because
aspiring
everybody knows
to forgiveness.
That it doesn't feel good to hold on to anger.
Exactly.
It doesn't feel good to clutch onto anger. And I wanted to interject that I think that this is so vital because a lot of people, and I don't know if this is what you, we haven't discussed exactly how you plan to unpack this or,
sure.
But I want to say that, you know, those of you who cling to relationships, which other people might have pointed out to you are toxic, or you deep in your soul have a sense there's something wrong about them and use the notion of forgiveness to excuse that, you might want to consider that this is a coping mechanism for you and that you're using the idea of forgiveness as a crutch, because that was so true for me that I used the concept of forgiveness as an absolute coping mechanism to get through my childhood and to normalize what was happening to me. This is fine. I don't have to talk about it. I don't have to process it because forgiveness, easy, done. Right? We don't
Absolutely.
Have to unpack this, talk it, process it, or even acknowledge what has happened to me, because people don't, as a rule, like to acknowledge that terrible things have happened to them. It's hard. It's much easier to just, you know, skirt around it, shove it under under the bed, under the rug, or make it smaller than it was. And I just did that. And I think almost every childhood victim of abuse is going to be inclined to do that, because that is how we survive.
And yeah,
and
I think
no shame in that.
Exactly.
No,
that's not a weakness. That's a survival mechanism.
That was a survival mechanism that allowed you to survive as a child and to get through life. Because if you were constantly cognizant of how monstrous it was that these terrible things were happening to you, you would not be able to have found any joy or have any friends or get along. And so it's a gift, but it doesn't really play well in adulthood. In adulthood, you have to actually pay the piper in terms of acknowledging, and that's a horrible way to put it, not pay the piper. It's just kind of a sad thing that you do have to take, you have to parse apart what happened to you as not your fault and external from you. And the only way to do that is to really acknowledge the fullness of it and the severity of how wrong it was.
And
then you can disentangle it from all the junk that you've told yourself about your own worthiness and all that stuff.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I think where people kind of shy away from it is that they think that, and this is the great paradox, is they think that processing your own trauma is a fairly self-indulgent process, where it's all about me and it's me.
That was most certainly drilled into us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Self-care being a form of self-indulgence. And I think
I remember it being referred to in our home, and just, you know, we don't actually want to get into any personal sort of details in this. We've, you know, that's had its day. But I think it's not unusual for people to come from households or ways of thinking or just, you know, backgrounds or cultures where it's thought of as weak. It's thought of as, what is the word?
Melodramatic.
Or
Histrionic.
Histrionic, self-indulgent.
Self-indulgent,
baby.
that kind of stuff.
There's a whole like litany of insulting kind of things, snowflakes or this or that or all the things. Which is so unfair and sad, because everybody at some point has to process shit that went down in their childhood. They just have to. Not and one the of thing us is,
why?
What?
Why do you have to do it? Well, firstly, you don't have to, because lots of people choose to, you know, just double down on their pain and just ignore it.
Mm.
But to me, the imperative behind addressing and healing from trauma and past, you know, past pain is for your family. For me, it was about my wife and my children.
Yeah, 100%.
Do I stay wounded and passing on that pain and damage to others through dysfunction? Or do I do the brave work of facing the horror of my pain and my trauma and how I internalized it and how damaging it was to me, and appear to be reveling in my own, you know, sort of realizations and, you know, really kind of going to town with my own pain outwardly, but yeah, actually be doing the real work that resolves that pain so that I can then be present in my current relationships, as opposed to constantly living in the past.
And no longer reacting. You're acting.
Exactly.
You're not behaving in a reactive way. Which
exactly.
Completely. You're not even cognizant of it sometimes. And you're not in the
exactly.
driving seat of your life. And, you know, I think this is a huge problem for men in Western culture, in other cultures too, probably even worse. But I spoke to a man recently who's, you know, really taking on this brave work of childhood trauma, trauma even in adulthood, and is and sort of said something laughingly about, oh, I'm just such a little girl now, I guess. And I was like, no, I've honestly never thought of you as more masculine as I do now, because a masculine man is willing to put himself in the most vulnerable position in order to save his children.
Absolutely.
And I really think that if you don't unravel whatever's eating at you, you are destined to visit it upon the head of your children and, of course, not be in control of your own life. And what is more masculine than being in control of your own actions? And, you know, so I just want to, you know, I know men listen to this, and we've just got to get rid of this weird stigma about mental health in men, because men are committing suicide more than women are. Men are under-medicated. They are not seeing the therapists and doctors the way they should be, because of this crazy stigma that somehow getting in touch with what's going on in your brain or dealing with trauma is for women. Or is it,
you know,
sort of like a weakness? It could not be less true.
And I think for most people who are reacting to trauma, they don't even realize that's what's happening. And so I think we almost have to unpack, what does it look like? Well, to me, it looked like having multiple diagnoses of mental illness and never really resolving them, and being medicated and trying different medications, and they were still playing up. So for me, it was OCD as a primary diagnosis with bipolar as a secondary diagnosis. And funnily enough, when I go back in history to when the bipolar label got added to me, it was at the time when all of the trauma came to a head, when you revealed what had happened to you, Kirsty. And I saw no correlation, obviously. All I knew was that my emotions were out of control, and I was trying to get them under control with addictive behavioral problems and eating and this and that.
And you were probably just, and what was actually happening is that you were constantly being triggered back to
absolutely
a helpless childhood.
Absolutely. And in the end, the only label I could put on it, on these emotional states that would just come upon me seemingly out of nowhere, the only label I could put on it was a bipolar label of a mixed episode, where you have the energy levels of a hypomanic phase, but the cognition of a depressed phase. So you are in a really low, really negative frame of mind, but you're filled with this energy, and you just want to destroy things. Exactly. And
that
usually
is very common, a very common manifestation in men.
Exactly, because the male, you know, men get socialized that acceptable expressions of emotion are anger, That's pretty much the only acceptable masculine expression of emotion. And so what happens is very violent, or they just try and drown out what they're feeling, and they don't know what they're feeling, and they drown it out with alcohol, or, you know, promiscuity, or porn, or gambling, or some form of addiction.
Or work.
Or work, exactly.
Success, or money, workaholism, yeah.
You name it.
Fight, and, you know, just, but like, and young boys will be aggressive and fight.
Sure, and, or even an obsession with sport.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whenever you're using an interest to numb yourself into a state of sort of calmness,
yeah,
it's becoming an addiction, really.
Yeah, and you know, like for me, running has become unhealthy at times, just to get sort of away from the demons. It's just, you know, I couldn't ever feel okay unless I was running.
Sleeping is another one.
Sleeping is a big one. You know, for women,
eating.
Men, a common misdiagnosis is sometimes ADHD or ADD. Because especially for women, is that they have so much trouble focusing. And I always think back, you know, I probably have been a decent student at school. I was bright. I was diligent. I wanted to please, but I couldn't focus because I was being abused. And you just can't, you're in a constant state of
autonomic arousal.
Yeah.
You know, so fight or flight
these
response.
Things are, you know, if you're like always trying to protect your very life, and you know, for me it wasn't that, but it's the same hormones, you know. Mm. I mean, so many balls were in the air. Nobody can know. And I was using so much energy into normalizing it in my mind, and then worrying about the most awful, horrible, terrible things that a child should never, ever have to worry about. And then at the same time, having to learn long division, you know, it's just too much. Mm-hmm. And so kids with ADD have often, you know, been, or women often get on stimulants. And so things came to a huge head for me with PTSD when I was put on Adderall, because I was doing my master's and I needed to focus. And I was doing my master's in mental health counseling, and I was highly triggered because I was dealing with a case study.
By the content, yeah.
A case study of child abuse. And it was just textbook, you know, of what had happened to me. And suddenly I'm in this hyper aroused situation because I've also got methamphetamines added to the whole situation, in the false belief that that would help me to focus. And well, that's a disaster. So it really is, you know, if you have been misdiagnosed with a bunch of different things, and you know you've got something in your past, or you suspect that there might be something, and a lot of people repress memories,
and also you just trivialize them.
I never thought
I had a right to believe that I had a traumatic childhood.
Well, especially if you are with abusers, because abusers do trivialize. And I have not met a single person who has been abused who hasn't struggled with the concept that it was a bad thing. And that is just classic.
Mm. And I think what you do is you see it on a spectrum.
Yeah.
And so you say, yes, you know, in my mind, one of the labels I'd put on my childhood was, you know, my father's a disciplinarian. And that's how I'd kind of packaged it. And in the, you know, the spectrum of abuse, I'm thinking of, you know, sex trafficking. I'm thinking of being beaten. Yeah. Being beaten, you know, with visible bruises and knocked unconscious, or having cigarettes put out on your chest.
Well, we were beaten with visible bruises, but we didn't think that was good enough because
precisely
we
it
never
wasn't
had to go to the hospital.
Or it wasn't, you know, it was under the guise of healthy discipline kind of thing. You know, it wasn't an angry parent beating you because they're drunk kind of thing.
The point is
you will always find someone who is a more obvious case for trauma. And so when it came out, when you started to share your story, I could completely understand, okay, Kirsty's got CPTSD. But when the therapist started to suggest that I might, it seemed, well, don't be silly.
It seemed compared to Kirsty, you were offended almost by the fact that
I was like, you're trivial.
My abuse by
exactly
being abused.
Don't trivialize what Kirsty went through by putting me in the same ballpark as her. And then you can have people who have grown up in one of my favorite books on the subject called CPTSD inducing families, where they were never hit. There was no sexual abuse, but there was an emotional culture of abuse and abandonment, et cetera, that have exactly the same outcomes.
Yeah, the conditional love and acceptance is terrifying for a child.
Exactly. So what you've got to deal with is, what is the outcome? Am I an adult who feels like something is wrong with me and I'm just not performing the way an adult should? I've got these kind of like hidden your ghosts offense in my closet. If that's the question, start looking into whether there is some trauma contributing to the way you're feeling. Because we like to put finite labels on it, like depression, because it's been destigmatized to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But if you say it's from childhood trauma, you feel like a little baby who's complaining about the fact that someone didn't invite you to play soccer with the other kids.
Have done a lot of people sort of done this pull yourself up by your bootstrap stuff, say it's not your parents' fault, it's you need to take responsibility for yourself and stuff. In the last couple of decades, that's become in vogue. And it's
But let's unpack that for a moment. How do you take responsibility for yourself? You take responsibility for your emotional state and for not passing that on to other people.
This is a good segue then back to what we wanted to talk about, because the thing is, one can go, well, absolutely, it was my parents' fault, and now it's my responsibility to take care of this. And I'm not going to, and, you know, not minimizing what your parents did allows you to disentangle who you are and love yourself fully and also forgive.
And this is the thing. I think if I want to be picky, and I hope you don't mind me being picky, I don't even like the word fault, because fault implies that people do things intentionally. And sometimes, and, you know, let's not go into the detail, but, you know, some of the stuff was intentional. Yes. But sometimes people are looking at their parents who did the very best that they could with what they were given in life. And so it's not even a case of fault. It's a case of causation. So let's look at the causal link between certain environmental factors growing up and certain outcomes as an adult. You don't have to throw around
the word
fault or damnation or anything.
I think that's
you're
very
just saying
helpful.
This caused that. I don't even judge you for it. I love you for doing the best you could with what you had in your arsenal of tools and you know, coping mechanisms. But I need to be honest about the fact that that caused this. And if I want to change this, I have to go back to that and unpack it.
Well, you know, I'm in a position even now where I look back on my children, my older four's childhood, while I was still under the grips of CPTSD and didn't know it, and how it had such an impact on how I raised those kids. And it was with absolute good faith. I tried so hard. I didn't want them to suffer any of the grief and pain of my childhood. And in fact, that neuroses of protecting them is super unhelpful and harmful. And so I'm looking back and unpacking their childhoods and going, you guys, mom made some super big mistakes because she did all she could with what she knew then. But looking back now, it was all.
It wasn't a lot.
And, you know, giving my own self grace, because I knew I was damaged doing my best, has allowed me to give a lot of parents who do some really damaging stuff grace, because they just did not have a clue of what was wrong with me, why I was acting this way, why I was so highly strung and apt to freak out, and I needed everything a certain way and just couldn't chill and what have you, you know, which has a huge fallout for delicate little kids' psyches. It really
does. Absolutely. You know, I think of I was struck by an analogy a little while ago. If you were given a, you know, high-performing Ferrari, like a top-of-the-line Ferrari, And you made some minor mistakes in inverted commas. You put in completely the wrong oil, or you failed to make certain, I'm not a car person, so I can't even use the right language. You failed to maintain it in a certain way. The outcome would be massive, and no one would say, oh, you're being melodramatic, that you wanted to put the right oil into this car. It's just a car.
Take the whole thing apart and strip it and clean it and put it back together because it's worth it, because it's a flipping Ferrari.
Exactly. But here we're raising these profoundly delicate, nuanced psyches who are so impressionable. And then we think it's too much to say that, oh, too much of this has an effect later on. It absolutely does. And I think if we can take fault and blame out of the scenario and just talk causality, then we can start having healthy conversations. Because then I can say to my children, listen, I'm concerned that because I was responding to X when you were young, I'm concerned that there might be a causal link between the way I did this and the way you internalize that. Let's have a conversation about it.
Yeah, and for people who are not like prone to revenge or justice or, you know, are not very even religiously inclined to mercy rather than justice.
Exactly, because this is why people don't.
Is super unattractive.
Very true.
Know? And none of this is clean. None of this is clean. You know, for us, we've managed to, the one part of our parenting sort of duo, we're just like, you're done. Like, we're done here for the most part. But even that was complex and painful and sad and whatever under those like incredibly, obvious circumstances. And absolutely. So if you've got somebody who's inflicted harm, even without meaning to, such as me on my own children, my kids often, resist it when I say, you guys, there's been stuff, you got to talk it through with therapists and stuff like that. They're like, mommy, no, we're fine, because they want to protect me. They don't like to see me as the bad guy because I'm not, and they know it. And it's very unpalatable to them to think of me in that sense. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not the bad guy. Don't worry about it. It's fine.
Well, I think this is where we can take ourselves out of the equation. Yes, where you can take yourself out of the equation and say, this isn't about me. Exactly. This is about how my actions affected you. So let's have the uncomfortable conversation around this dynamic in our family. And I think people are scared to have the conversation because they think the only way to have it is to wield the sword of damnation that condemns the parents for their faults. Rather than saying, I love you, thank you for everything you gave me. This is, I'm really grateful for it. I need to address this issue. Can you address it with me? And if we can be mature enough to have that conversation, then relationships are salvageable. When they're not salvageable is when people see that conversation as an indictment of them as a person. And they see it as a final judgment and they're unable to have the conversation constructively.
And sadly, mostly people do that because they themselves are damaged and triggered.
For
and
sure.
They have experienced abandonment and conditional love themselves.
Yeah.
And so any kind of criticism on them is just a rejection. And that comes from their own damage. And so it can take a lot of patience. So if people are willing to work towards that and people are patient with them enough to do that, that can work sometimes.
Let's talk about boundaries then.
Yeah.
In the context of such a relationship. So say you've got a relationship with a parent.
Yeah.
And as a result of choices that were made by the parent, you are left with large amounts of trauma that are triggered very easily by existing dynamics in that relationship. Is it unforgiving for you to draw a boundary where you need some space away from that person? And it doesn't have to be a parent. It can be a work colleague, for heaven's sake. It could be anyone. Is it unforgiving to draw a boundary to protect yourself from being hurt by someone. And I think this is the thing that needs to be interrogated, because in, and I'm going to just dive into what I think is a problematic mindset.
The popping is getting so bad though. So, okay.
That, yeah. Oh, it's that little, I hear
you.
Can you
hear it?
I can now that you pointed out.
Is your phone plugged in?
It's not, but it's got battery.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering what's causing it.
We live out in the, bush.
Okay. Our internet connection. But
although my internet connection shows, you know, full strength at the moment.
Okay. Go on. We'll listen to this later and see if it's,
if the quality's okay.
If the quality is salvageable.
So let's look at a situation where a man compulsively beats his wife. And, you know, there are certain situations where we find it easy to understand boundaries. And then when we transfer that into a different scenario, then suddenly we go blurry. So let's say every Friday night, a man gets drunk and he beats his wife up. And she spends, a night in hospital. And Monday morning, she comes back. He's sober. He sobs. He pleads. You know, he asks her to forgive him, et cetera, et cetera. Forgiveness looks like her saying, I don't judge you as an evil person because you've done this to me.
Well, you're sick. You're an alcoholic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, if this cycle continues over and over and over again, for her to say, I love you, I want the best for you, I want you to recover, I want you to be happy, you're dear to me, you're the father of my children, you mean everything to me, but this is not healthy, and so I'm going to remove myself and my children from this scenario. Everyone's comfortable with that kind of boundary, because it has like a physical manifestation.
Well, even if it happens one time.
Well, hello. Yes. Hello. I'm just saying, but I'm painting
that one time people are pretty chill about it. Also.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, but I'm just painting the scenario where no one would argue, no, she needs to stay.
Yeah.
She needs to stay, you know, where the man says, yes, I am going to keep drinking and I might still beat you up, but I love you. And during the week, I'm going to make it up to you.
Yeah.
No one would advocate
out there and bring home a decent paycheck and mow the lawn.
No one, I hope no one would advocate for that woman to stay in that scenario.
No, there would be still people, but yes.
Well, yeah, we'll talk to those who wouldn't.
Yeah.
Now you're in a scenario where, due to the emotional dynamics of a relationship, time after time after time,
they hurt.
Pain is dug up within the victim, let's call him for want with the survivor, or let's even go away from that terminology. Let's just say in a relationship with another person, time after time, you find yourself in the same emotional dynamics that exact a torturous toll on your well-being and on your ability to be present and functional for the people that you have chosen to spend your life with.
Yeah, so, that's a very, very key component. That's because people aren't willing to look at, oh, how does this hurt me? And how does it make me feel sick and make my heart race and make a stomach, you know, a pain in my stomach and make me feel like dying? But if they can see, well, and also it makes me lash out at my kids and be irritable and distracted and not want to, you know, then
want
they're
to
more
escape from
to
life.
Connect the dots, which is tragic, really, because you know,
we should
very
do it for ourselves.
In tune. We should be in tune with whatever even unsettles our soul.
Absolutely.
But yeah,
I mean, let me paint a scenario here where a few years back, before I even knew what was going on, I would Friday night would come and I would realize, okay, great. Nothing's expected of me tomorrow in terms of having to show up at work. Yeah. And so my drug of choice was sugar, and it sounds humorous until I explain how I was using it. During the week, I wouldn't have any sugar because it triggers migraines for me. And so on Friday night, I will have saved up every dessert that was on offer during the week. I will have bought some chocolates, bought some candy, and I would, you know, I would have cake and pudding and, you know, the whole thing.
So you're straight up binging.
Totally. I would line it up on the dining room table, get the kids to bed, and then I would systematically go through every bit of sugar I could lay my hands on.
But you knew full well that you're going to be in terrible pain.
Well, yes, but what I would do is I would eat to the point of just short of throwing up, and then I would take the biggest whack of painkillers I could find, and then I would go to bed. And then and then Saturday I would wake up at 10, 11 in the morning, and life would go on.
Nice now, for your wife.
Precisely. So I can say, well, you know, I don't want to have to address the pain of the past. It's too uncomfortable. And so now what I'm doing is I'm transferring it onto my wife and my children. Because Saturday morning when the kids get up and they start making noise and they're just excited to be alive, I'm asking them, please be quiet. Or I'm putting them in front of the TV.
You have such a headache.
Because I've got a migraine and I can't face them. And my wife sits there alone on Friday night. And what would have been a happy, nurturing family time Friday, Saturday, turns into me just trying to white knuckle through the weekend, which is hugely triggering every time.
And that's so interesting, because that's like a teetotaler's version of drinking to oblivion.
Well, this is when I started to realize this is more than just having a sweet tooth. I'm using sugar the way an alcoholic would use alcohol. I'm using it to find
food in the same way.
Exactly. I'm using it to find oblivion, just like you said. So the question is, if I have a relationship in my life that sends me to this point over and over and over again, forgiveness is saying, I don't judge you for the effect that you have on my life. I take responsibility for the fact that this is my response. Someone else could have responded very differently to that environment.
But and maybe they do.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm sure many of them do.
But I am taking responsibility for the fact that I currently am not capable of responding in a healthier way. And so I'm going to put a boundary in place that says I'm not going to have contact with that person while they have that kind of effect on me. Right. And I think I kind of want to go out on a ledge here. I think where a lot of Christians go wrong, at least within my faith tradition, is they see forgiveness as allowing the person right back into your life with relaxing any boundaries.
I can take it. I'm putting on the armor of God
You know, you haven't forgiven them unless you're willing to face them and give them a hug and let them back into your living room
and
invite them over for Christmas and talk to them over the phone when they want to chat, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a false concept of forgiveness. Forgiveness is about whether you judge that person and the state of their soul in eternity. It's got nothing to do with whether you choose to let your relationship with that person cloud the relationships that you have actively chosen to nurture in your life. And
so what if the relationship that you're dealing with is one that you have actively chosen to nurture in your life? So let's make it like that a little bit more complex here.
So, you know, I think that's a really good question. It's got to do with whether that relationship can exist independently of the dynamic. So can this dynamic be isolated and overcome? And I think when you're dealing with a spouse, you know, in the run-up to me being diagnosed with CPTSD, my spouse and I were triggering each other terribly, all with the best intentions. But that is a relationship that I am committed to and obliged to work through.
Right. Put a lot more effort into that one than you
Well, the point is you've got to be willing to try everything, in my view, before terminating that relationship. However, if you get to a point where you are incapable, and I'm not just talking about binge eating, I'm talking about relationships that become terribly destructive to the children, because the two participants can't get out of that toxic space between them.
Well, I don't even want to go there. Okay. I don't want to even go there. I want to focus on what is it doing to your inner child? Because that is something that was so pivotal for me when you said to me, so long as you keep betraying your inner child, Kirsty, you are going to be in hell. So long as you stay in a relationship or you, you know, entertain a relationship with somebody who is, who makes you feel unsafe and makes you,
where you're violating your inner sense.
You are violating your own boundaries because you know this person has a history of making you feel unsafe and you keep going back to it. That inner child is learning. Adult Kirsty said she was here for me, but like every other bloody adult, she's not. And she goes back into this horrible, terrible, wounded child state. And so my kids may be ostensibly, we might fool ourselves into being like, no, look, this is this inner turmoil. I still smile at Ella in the morning. I still get stuff done. I still, you know, I manage to play nice with my family, whatever. Because a lot of people won't get out of these terrible relationships or won't even work on them because they're like, no, we've got our shit together pretty tightly. We're not letting it affect the kids.
And we've got our coping mechanisms.
They have an idea of what affecting the kids looks like, and it's yelling or it's, you beating. Know, tight-lippedness. And it's like, no. If you're, I think a really good rule of thumb is, how do you feel? And if your inner child is feeling sick, you are not all you can be. And that is a terrible, terrible travesty of a life.
Yeah. And I think,
and
with a relationship,
me that yourself. Said to me, don't make it about the kids, Kirsty. You in and of yourself are worthy of feeling okay.
Very true.
You know, because when I was like, you know what, I decided to stay in the church. And this is ironic because you are in the Mormon faith, still very devout. Mm-hmm. And I decided it was best for me and my family to leave. And we're both very comfortable with our respective decisions and comfortable with each other.
Yeah.
Having, you know, made those decisions for each other. But I said, you know, well, I've just decided to stay with it because, you know, the long-term of the children. And you said, no, you've got to decide to stay for it for your own soul. Mm. You yourself, Kirsty, are worthy in and of yourself.
Mm.
And that was a very, like, you know, so I get really like, I get, you know, you could see I leapt on that in very with alacrity, and you taught me to leap on that. So
no,
I'm
but
just you, like,
you're absolutely right. I think, and you know, I get very scared of giving any kind of prescriptive. If you find yourself in this,
marriages.
yes, that's where I go fuzzy because it's so deeply personal.
But the thing is, toxicity is toxicity.
Exactly.
And you taught me another thing recently, and I want you to give that quote that you said to me a couple of weeks ago, just because, what was it?
Because a toxic person does something nice for you doesn't mean
or
that
has or is capable of being nice to you.
Yeah, just because a toxic person is capable of being kind to you doesn't mean you should keep them in your life. It just means that doing the right thing becomes harder.
Exactly.
Because I think if you, and let's talk about family relationships, extended family, for instance.
Yeah.
Parents,
and
siblings.
Like, I mean, if that's safer ground for you. But the thing is, the ugly truth is that some people are in very, very, very toxic marriages with narcissists, for instance, and will never, ever, ever, ever be able to make those work.
The rule of thumb is if you can't negotiate that relationship, whether it be a marriage or a parent-child relationship or a sibling relationship, if you cannot negotiate that relationship into a place where your boundaries are not being violated, and therapy can't get you there, then you aren't doing anyone
Precisely.
A favor by staying in that relationship.
And that is the crux of it. If your inner child is being betrayed by you staying in that relationship because you are not safe, you do not feel safe and at peace, it is threatened for some reason. It doesn't matter whose responsibility it is. It just can't work. Like you're saying, people are not well served. Nobody's served.
Yeah.
Nobody is served.
And this is the thing, I think, from a community point of view, it's very easy for people to stand on the outside and to say, well, then you haven't really forgiven them. And again, they're two separate issues. I can love and forgive Absolutely. Someone and mourn and weep for their loss in my life.
Absolutely.
But I can say...
And miss them terribly in the good exactly. times.
Exactly. Yeah. And long for their well-being and long for them to be happy and to find ultimate joy in life. But I can also say at the same time, if I allow you to stay in my life, my children and my wife pay the price for it. And that isn't fair.
Indeed.
That just isn't fair.
Yeah. But you alone, you just being alone, you paying the price for it alone is enough. Let's go back to it.
No, but why do they pay the price? Because I'm violating unhappy. Self. I'm violating myself. And I think you have to draw the distinction between inconvenience and mm-hmm. discomfort. Relationships mm-hmm. are inconvenient and they're uncomfortable and they're painful and they're exhausting. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about being in a relationship, being a violation of self just by virtue of being in it.
Well, you feel that's sick a very and different afraid thing. And violated. There's a difference. You will know the difference. You can sense when something feels unhealthy.
So does the thought of speaking to this person on the telephone cause a panic attack? Do you know, these are the kind of questions you need to ask yourself.
Or do you have wonderful, great interactions, but it always comes back around eventually to you crying?
Yeah, or feeling broken for a few days.
I'm back in this. It's happening again. Do you come back to being a broken person? Yeah. Because, look, my husband and I are so fortunate in that we have a very easy, loving relationship. And we have many disagreements and frustrations with each other. And, I mean, we've been married for close to 25 years. We've raised 5 kids. There's just been myriads of things have happened. And, of course, we, being two personalities and two different people, have quirks and have disagreements and are profoundly different people and have, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, can I say that this man has ever broken me? Has this man ever made me feel doubt in myself as a worthy human being?
Preyed on that doubt.
Or thought, is there something super wrong with me? And implied that there was. Mm. You know, those are toxic traits. Those are very, very different things. And so, yes, we've had fights. And yes, I've cried. In frustration. And yes, I've been so angry that I've wanted to like punch a wall or, you know, throw a thing from time to time, very unusually, to be honest. But
absolutely.
But I've never felt like a broken, frightened child because of something he said or something that he's manipulated. I've never felt put on the spot. I've never felt my heart racing that I was in trouble. Mm. I felt safe and unconditionally accepted and okay with who I am. In his presence.
And I think even sometimes in marital relationships, dynamics shadow. So you could have had a toxic parent or an abusive parent where something in your spouse reminds you of that. Mm. Of that. That's not cause to throw a relationship out because that person isn't the root cause of that dynamic. As you heal from the trauma of the abuse,
you'll see
those shadows lift. But if that person is a source, if that person is casting the shadow themselves through the way that they are abusive towards you, then you've got a different story.
Well, if you feel a desperation, if you feel like when you have a fight, you have a frantic need to smooth things over, or this person's going to leave me. Oh my gosh. You know, that kind of sense of fear of abandonment. If any of those childlike fears are triggered, it's different. I had my husband, weirdly enough, during the time that I was deeply in PTSD, sort of in the throes of the deepest things, was wearing something that triggered me. And I wasn't even aware of it. Mm. I just knew that at night I couldn't have him in the same bed as me. Mm. And he very patiently just slept elsewhere. And we couldn't, you know, I just came up in therapy eventually and we solved it. He never wore the thing again and solved, done. But in my interactions with him, I knew full well that this man wasn't a dangerous man. I was just like, there's something that I can't have you around at night. I wonder what it is. You know, I could easily, I could sense it, differentiate in my soul that there was something, you know, environmentally or he was doing was, I could tell.
Exactly. It's someone else's shadow falling over your loved one.
Exactly.
As opposed to them casting their own shadow.
Right. And thank goodness he had the maturity and the kindness
to
and
respect
wisdom
the
and
boundary.
Whatever to stay through that and to be patient through that. And to do whatever work that was necessary to do on his part so that, you know, he wouldn't trigger me and I wouldn't trigger him and all those things. But when there's a person who's kind of unapologetically sort of coming back around and around and around to behaviors that knowingly trigger you. And it's just like, well, this is who I am.
Unknowingly harmful.
Yeah. This is who I am.
And I think,
like it or leave it, then you got to leave it.
And I think something that I would like to address is a, let's just say a parental figure where a lot of what they do is really kind and really nurturing and really, really outwardly loving. But there are certain dynamics in that relationship that are deeply traumatic and triggering on an ongoing basis. And so the question is, do you,
so
you know,
complicated.
And I would like to, I came up with this analogy once that I really liked, and I'm wondering if I could quickly share it with you.
Please do.
So, in my head, I have this image of these two sort of English countryside cottages. And in between the cottages is this beautiful old stone wall with moss on it. And just this kind of soft, gentle demarcation of a boundary between the two cottages. And to me, that's what healthy boundaries look like. They're a demarcation. This is mine. That's yours. And it's a boundary that can be crossed in appropriate ways, but it is native to me. It's natural. It's reflexive, and it happens automatically. Now, when you have someone who's grown up,
and it's not confusing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you have someone who has grown up in an abusive environment, like myself, like yourself, that stone wall has literally been knocked down, so that the rocks have been torn down and they've been scattered around, and you've been made to feel guilty for even implying that there should be a wall there.
Yeah.
And so what happens in that case is you can have your neighbors on the other side of this destroyed boundary doing innocuous things like saying, "Hi, we just showed up to play ball with you." But the fact that they are in your property and you have no power to keep them out becomes something that is hugely triggering and stressful for you.
Yeah.
And on the surface,
literally
on the surface, the neighbor is saying, "What? We just brought a picnic over. Like, what is the big problem here?" But the point is, the fact that there is no wall makes that excursion into your garden a violatory one. And in cases where they have been abused, the analogy is someone from the neighbor's cottage, someone has gone further, has snuck into your house and destroyed things or stolen things or done something terrible to the people inside that house. So the violation is even deeper. But let's just say it's just a case of you're feeling violated because there are no boundaries. For a while, you are going to have to erect a very impermeable, sort of very clinical structure, like some palisade fencing with boarding, to keep them out until you start to feel safe in your own home, until you have the time to go and find those rocks and put them back where they should have been in the first place. And that takes a long time. And people will stand and judge you for having put a palisade fence between you and your neighbor, because that's so unchristlike and that's so cruel and it's just so cold and unneighborly. But the point is, until your natural wall can be back in place and be in, you know, native to you and feel comfortable to you, any visit from those neighbors, just a friendly, hey, we brought you some jam, is a violation.
Sobering.
And
sobering. People, it's so tempting to let people sort of have those casual relationships and be precisely, like, I can handle this. I've got this.
Precisely.
I can do this.
And you know what? You cannot. It doesn't work for me today. I'm doing my washing. I'm in my underwear. Yeah. But, oh, you know, they did bring over some jam. And so how do I say to them, sorry, please don't come across. And you can't, where there's no boundaries, it's a minefield. Yeah, so you've got to put up a false boundary that says, stay out of my garden completely. Yeah. Don't bring me jam. Don't lean over to ask me what the weather is doing. Stay out of my property.
My little inner kid over here.
Yes. Until
you've got a
monster
face on right now.
Yes.
Go
until
away.
I can build my wall again.
Yeah.
I've got to build my wall. And when my wall is sound, then you can poke your head over the wall and say, hey, do you guys want to
we'll
come
see.
Over?
Yeah.
Yes. Because then I can say, no, thanks. I don't want to today.
But, you know, I love this analogy, but I want to bring in, because for me, you have been so helpful to me in bringing in this inner child perspective.
I just worry that inner child scares people. That's why I don't
but
go
the thing
there
is, look,
very
I
easily.
Get that,
but it's
but you know
so.
What? You've got to just speak to your tribe, whoever they are. And if they're scared by it, then they'll find someone else. And we've got to be honest with what we know.
Yeah.
And for me, that really, like, I also was very icked out. And I didn't like it. I didn't like to talk about my inner child. It seemed very like precious and sort of icky.
Self-indulgent, our usual narrative.
And it seemed silly, and it seemed very like classically like psychobabble. But the thing is, people do tend to identify if they think of protecting a small child. And for the longest time when I was in therapy, I used to get very hung up, like, if I was highly triggered, like especially triggered, I'd be like, Ella's not safe. Ella's not safe today.
Interesting.
It's too hard for Ella. It's, you know, I must go and get Ella from school. Mm. Stuff like that. And my therapist would be like, Ella's fine and chill. Like, Ella has got it. And I'd be like, cognizant, you know, of course she does. Ella's the most confident person I've ever met. But she'd be like, it's you. It's your inner child is like freaking out, girl. And so, you know, it was very, very literal for me. But if people can look on it as your inner child, you have now been charged to reparent and protect and be as best a parent as possible too. And if your inner child is freaked out by the neighbor poking their fat face over the fence and looking at them, it is up to you to go, don't you ever bring your fat face near my kid again.
Well, absolutely.
And I don't care if people judge me for that. That's the thing. If we are in a place, because we all see virtue and nobility in protecting a child, don't we?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. And in that analogy, I kind of have children living in my cottage.
Exactly. And that's what I mean. I'm like, you've got your sweet, precious children.
Exactly. And when your children say, Daddy, that man scares me. That man scares me.
Yeah.
Do I say, well, suck it up,
no,
because
be
I'm
fine.
Going to be offending the town's plumber and we might need plumbing?
Yeah.
Or do I say, sorry, please don't come in. My kids are scared of you.
My kids are scared. And that's the thing. And you will do so much for a child. And so if you do it for your inner child and go, look, listen, the inner child knows that we're just having a casual chat over here. And nothing of any importance is being said. They're not going to hurt me. This is just, you know, this is a holiday, or this is a that, or this is a this. If you're betraying your inner child, because an inner child doesn't know that. They're scared. They're hiding behind your legs.
Yeah.
It's cruel. It's mean. It's irresponsible.
And then work on healing your inner child.
Yes.
But
so
understand.
The inner child is a lot more
robust.
Robust.
But, and here, if I can paint one last little picture, and then I suppose, you know, we're going to kill people if we keep talking. But one last picture. Here's the scenario. I've got someone on the other side of that broken down wall who came in and hurt one of my children. Didn't just, you know, came in and hurt my violated them in some way. Yeah. Okay. Then I've got the rest of that person's family.
That was an Afrikaans expression I just used, which meant I will stab them. Sorry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you've got the man living, or let's just say the tenant. No, let's say the man living next door, and he has hurt one of my children. Right. And I lay down the law and I say to him, listen, buddy, you're no longer welcome on my property because I thought I could trust you. I left you alone with my kid while I went inside to get lemonade. I came out, my kid was crying, and you had purposely cut them on the arm. No, you are not allowed in my home. If I see you in my home, I will call the police. Great. No one's going to have a problem. You can't be going around cutting other people's kids. Great. But then where it becomes complicated is the man's sweet wife comes over with a picnic that she and the children have made. And they say, we've made you this beautiful picnic. And you say, thank you. And you welcome them and you make, you know, you put a rug down, a blanket down, and you all sit down together. And then the man starts lurking in the background and the wife says, please, can he come and join us? Yeah. And you say, no, I've made it clear that he's not welcome on this property. And she says, but my children can't enjoy themselves unless he's here. Can't you make an exception? Because we're here. Don't go inside. Don't go make lemonade. You'll be able to see that he won't go near. He will not. And he's left his knife at home. And he's not going to cut your child again. And you get put on this guilt trip that you're not like, letting the man on the boundaries. Exactly. And
it's just so ludicrous. You're like, here's my kid crying because he's this cutting man.
No, because every time my kid sees that man, he sees the glint in his eyes. He remembers what it felt like to be sliced on the arm. Or even worse, you know, I stay away from really damaging things because it's triggering for people. But think worse. Worse things could have been done to that child, you know?
Exactly.
And so if it gets to a point that every time my neighbors come over, I am made to feel guilty for not letting their cutting husband come with them, then eventually they're not going to be welcome anymore.
Yeah, no, like, stop it.
And
plus, how unseemly and unkind is it for them to even put you in that position?
But people do it,
all the time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you paint it in this ridiculous scenario like this, you can see it as how ridiculous it is and how unkind and insensitive it is for people to expect you to fraternize with people who, they're no longer a harm, they're no longer a threat, can't you just get over it, what have you.
So this is the thing, that he can be rehabilitated.
Mm.
The point is,
your inner child,
does my inner child feel safe having that man on the property or not? And then the next thing is, have I forgiven him? Do I sit there and teach my child to hate the man next door? Or do I help them to see that the man was on tuck and that's why he cut the child? And he's actually
in South Africa, you know.
He's actually really, you know, he's got some great traits. We don't judge him. We love him. We want the best for him, but it's just, he's not going to come on the property. That's what forgiveness
is. We'll keep you safe and you can forgive him from afar.
Exactly. You're capable of forgiving him because you know he can't hurt you again.
It reminds me of this little girl who is friends of ours, and she was in North Carolina and she was bitten by a shark. A little girl, right? And she instantly said, like, listen, everybody, please don't, you know, demonize the shark. We don't hate the shark. We love the shark. The shark was being a shark and I was in its home and it thought I was food and it bit my leg. So this little girl forgave the shark frankly and easily and beautifully, but nobody is going to expect her to freaking bathe with a shark or swim with a shark or even go to the aquarium if she doesn't want to go to the aquarium.
And if she says
safely behind
behind
big bits of glass. Like,
exactly.
No.
And when people say, but honey, the odds of you being bitten a second time are, you know, let's ramp it up.
It's the same shark.
Let's ramp it up. This is a surfer who's lost their leg, their entire leg to a shark attack. And he's saying, you know what? it's just a mental hang up I have. I don't want to keep surfing.
Yeah.
Are we going to say, oh, you coward. You're so unforgiving.
Yeah, what is you're wrong so unforgiving. With you, sick, twisted?
No, don't go around demonizing sharks. But if you feel safer on land, not risking having another... No, but it's so uncommon that you would be bitten again.
Yeah.
But that's not where I feel safe anymore.
Exactly.
And I'm entitled to that.
Sorry.
I'm entitled to that.
All the time shy.
Yeah. Especially when the same shark still hangs out in that same little, you know, bay.
Shark didn't even say sorry a lot of the time.
Or the shark has been biting other people. You know what I mean? It's
There's lots of ways we can take this, but I think people can start to see that, you know, when you take it out of this, like, these weird constructs of family relations where people think that they, you know, they should trump all, that they should overcome all. It is Christmas time.
It's Christmas. And so the man must come with his pocket knife. He's going to get a new pocket knife for Christmas. He must come and sit down and at the table next to your child, but we'll watch him. We'll watch him.
No, don't worry. Yeah, we'll keep the kids safe and the kids cowering and can't enjoy Christmas or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's like, family relations don't, you know, it's the same bloody shark. It's still a shark. A shark is a shark. And even if it isn't the same shark, if the inner child is like, no, you know, I don't like a shark anymore. I don't like a shark. I don't feel safe. I might love a shark like the girl. I'm messing up my analogies like crazy.
No, you're fine. You're
fine. We probably should have folded when we were good. But I forgive a shark. I see that a shark was just being a shark.
And
what have you. Please don't hate the shark. But let's not bath with the shark. Put a shark in this public swimming pool.
And I don't want reminders of him.
I don't like to see them at the aquarium either.
Yeah, I don't like reminders. I have people in my life who remind me of abusive dynamics.
Yeah.
And I stay away from them, not because they're evil or I judge them, but because I know that this dynamic is going to bring up reactive behavior in me that makes everyone around me miserable, including the person who triggers me. And it's not fair to them for me to be constantly reacting to a ghost from the past in the present.
Good
it's
point.
Just not fair to them.
Yeah, it's just why.
And I think my closing thought is when that very austere, very clinical barrier that you put up in the interim is making you feel like you're a bad person, is stressing you out, is making you feel anxious, realize it is not the end goal. The end goal is to have this beautiful, organic, moss-covered rock wall that is healthy and natural and reflexive and normal to you. But until that can be built, you've got to have this austere palisade fence with plastic sheeting.
Yeah, because people don't get boundaries. They don't understand them.
They don't.
Them
and
super obvious. Yeah.
And even if other people get them, at this point, you don't get them.
Yeah, that's a beautiful point, because that's the thing. We had no grasp of boundaries. We just
And until know. Until I can learn boundaries, I can't even chat to the neighbors over the fence when there's a history with those neighbors.
Yeah.
And once my boundary is back and safe and healthy, then maybe I can engage with the neighbors and we can see whether we can salvage a healthy relationship. But right now, I need time to put up my wall again.
And can we just, that's your closing thought. And can mine be, and honestly, sometimes you're just going to have to leave the wall up. There are people that are always going to be dangerous. They'll get another knife.
Exactly. And if I am constantly being undermined by their visits, then I'm just going to say, let's, you know, I'll grow a hedge.
It's sometimes, you know, like I said, with the little girl and the shark, she can love the shark from afar and go, look, the shark was being a shark. What are you going to do? A shark is a shark. But I'm not ever going to go and swim in waters that have sharks again. That's how it's got to be.
Yeah.
And fine. You know, fine. Absolutely fine.
Well, thank you.
So thank you for this wonderful chat. I hope that we can salvage. The end half was brilliant in terms of sound quality, from what I can tell.
Good.
So we'll see what we've got. And thank you so much, Seth. I hope you will become a regular on the podcast.
We've actually talked
about having a podcast, an ongoing podcast. If you guys are interested in us kind of teaming up on more topics.
And like shorter. We'll make them sound bites instead of just an exploration.
We could even cut this one into sound bites, you know, so we can see how this goes. But feedback would be brilliant. We would love feedback on what kind of things you want to discuss, what resonated with you, what didn't, what felt wrong.
I think we definitely need to talk about raising kids with healthy boundaries.
Oh, yeah. There's so many things. Because this is I'm finding it's such a universal problem. If you don't have this issue, your wife, your husband, your best friend, your secretary, your, you know, ballet teacher, somebody's got something like this going on that you want to help. And we are just all in it together. We are all here to help each other. And we really feel called to take the pain that we've experienced and the lessons that we've learned and help as many people as we can with them. So please do chime in with input, good, bad, ugly questions, whatever. I am Kirsty Sayer on Facebook. You can message me there. I have a public Facebook page, Marmity Kirsty on Instagram, 1 inch par scary. Is my life coaching business and website. So you can reach me there. Seth, where can people reach you?
I'm appalling at social media.
Yeah, but you have like an email.
Yes, I have an email address.
Go for it.
Should I? Oh, sure. It's randall.seth@gmail.com.
Yeah,
randall.seth@gmail.com.
Let us know how we can be of assistance to you. Thank you again, Seth. I love you so much. I owe you
love
so
you
much.
Too.
You are wonderful. And we will do this again soon, I think.
Cool. Love you lots.
All right. Take care.
Bye. Bye.